We have a new Cross and Lotus Journal out, and I'm reading from Dear Friends. During my coming of age, I questioned every traditional value I was given. This included simple things such as, why use shampoo for my hair versus just using soap? To the incredibly important issues such as, what is truth? I wanted to know the reason and value of everything. And if it did not bear up to scrutiny, then I did not want to continue it out of any mindless acceptance. In many ways, this desire to know the utilitarian need of anything in life served me well. It made me explore the need and value of a spiritual life. It broke me from acceptance of dogma that did not make sense. But it also meant rediscovering the wheel the hard way, when it came to hard-won and valuable principles that have been handed down many thousands of years because they made life better. One such value was emphasized by both Master and Mother. It is the notion of loyalty. The dictionary meaning loyalty, unswerving in allegiance, as faithful in allegiance to one's lawful sovereign or government, faithful to a private person to whom fidelity is due, faithful to a cause, ideal, custom, institution, or product. Loyalty can touch any part of our lives. My father expressed his loyalty to a sports team by coming to a game early and watching the warm-ups and staying to the sometimes bitter end of a game, no matter how terribly the team played. I did not feel any obligation to be loyal to anything other than wanting to know the truth. Then Mother Hamilton came into my life as a result of my search for truth. I felt God so greatly in Mother. I was drawn to her and came to revere and love her. This feeling of love and reverence grew in me as I experienced the truth coming from her through her own experience, and as I began to verify that same truth in myself. I remember long ago when a devotee of Mother's, Raul Ralph Becerra, once said in conversation that he was so devoted to Mother that if someone tried to shoot her with a gun, he would stand in front of her and take the bullet. I was struck by his simple honesty in saying such a thing, reflecting that I could imagine myself doing the same thing gladly. My sense of loyalty grew out of my love and reverence for Mother, verified by the truth I heard from her and my growing experience in it. It came upon me so stealthily that I am not sure I ever gave it a name or its due importance. When I took Kriya initiation, I promised God and Guru I would practice Kriya meditation morning and night and follow the precepts of the Guru, and I took this oath perhaps without really thinking of its implications. Just the simple commitment to practicing Kriya morning and night became a great challenge at times. There were circumstances where it was not convenient. I remember when I drove semi-trucks and I was in the Mahamudra in the sleeper, bent over and not having enough room to totally get upright. But I did the posture the best the circumstances allowed. I awoke early. When traveling in Holland and staying at a youth hostel, I was quietly meditating in the lower portion of the bunk bed when loud music started playing over the loudspeakers sometime after 6 a.m. to wake up the sleepers, and the racket nearly made me jump out of my skin. But even more serious challenges came as I faced various fears and internal demons that haunted my subconscious mind. There were times when I wanted to be anywhere, but staying on my meditation asana. In going through this resistance, my loyalty was severely tested. When Mother experienced so much physical illness and picking the easy fruit of feeling the spiritual power and upliftment emanating from her was not readily available, many began to stay away and after a while left altogether. Seeing Mother in this terrible condition God gave her made me question what was happening to her. I wanted to know the truth. So I went inside in deep prayer and meditation, asking God and Guru for an answer. I did not move until I received it. Then came the revelation as a vision in my asana. Mother was there, a blazing light, and a powerful thought transference came her words, "Do you not know I am in my light body?" Mother had crossed the barrier of my doubt and disturbance and given me, as she always did, the truth. From that point on, I did not experience any doubt as to Mother's nature or who she really was. Only through Mother's grace was this possible. I will say that the grace of the vision did follow my determination to know the truth and my steadfastness in seeking it through God and Guru. I did not try to seek the answer through my sense mind. A blind sense of loyalty could not have sustained me, and yet it was loyalty to God and Guru and the truth that opened the door of revelation and understanding. There have been times in my sadhana that I have not lived up to Mother's teachings. I fell short many times. Each time I fell short, I paid a great price, and others have been hurt as well. The pain of those occasions is carved into my mind, and they stand as unmovable pillars of warning. These lessons in the negative have only confirmed the truth Mother taught. But these hard consequences have also taught me lessons in loyalty. To stay loyal, even when falling short of the ideal, requires humility. Humility made me know that truth was more important than my need to justify what I did. It put truth first, and my ego came far down the line in the list of what was important or essential. If emotions such as pride and shame, or fear and anger, had overshadowed truth, then I would have been lost. Mother once said that seekers come to the teacher thinking that the teacher needs to measure up to their standards, but that she, as the teacher and guru, had already measured up by paying the price and becoming a realized being, and that in reality, it was the seeker-disciple who needed to measure up. She is, of course, exactly right. Loyalty has grown in me, even as I have grown in experience and truth. I see now, not only through the lens of my own experience, but through the lives of so many seekers and disciples whom it has been my privilege to serve. I now see the essential nature of being loyal, and that without it, there are limits to growth and realization. With loyalty, realization of the great truth and becoming spiritually free is a reality close at hand. Last week I spoke about Shraddha and her meeting with Anandi Moy Ma, and I thought I'd read from the autobiography of a yogi, chapter 45, The Bengali Joy-Permeated Mother. "Sir, please do not leave India without a glimpse of Nirmala Devi. Her sanctity is intense. She is known far and wide as Anandi Moy Ma, Joy-Permeated Mother. My niece, Amyo Bose, gazed at me earnestly. Of course, I want very much to see the woman saint." I added, "I have read of her advanced state of God realization. A little article appeared about her years ago in East West." "I have met her," Amyo went on. "She recently visited my own little town of Jamshedpur. At the entreaty of a disciple, Anandi Moy Ma went to the home of a dying man. She stood by his bedside. As she touched his forehead, his death rattle ceased. The disease vanished at once. To the man's glad astonishment, he was well." A few days later, I heard that the blissful mother was staying at the home of a disciple in Bonapur, section of Calcutta. Mr. Wright and I set out immediately from my father's Calcutta home. As the Ford neared the Bonapur house, my companion and I observed an unusual street scene. Anandi Moy Ma was standing in an open-topped automobile, blessing a throng of about 100 disciples. She evidently, on the point of departure, Mr. Wright parked the Ford some distance away and accompanied me on foot toward the quiet assemblage. The woman saint glanced in our direction. She alit from her car and walked toward us. "Father, you have come." With these fervent words, she put her arm around my neck and her head on my shoulder. Mr. Wright, to whom I just remarked that I did not know the saint, was hugely enjoying this extraordinary demonstration of welcome. The eyes of the 100 cellas were also fixed with some surprise on the affectionate tableau. I had instantly seen that the saint was in a high state of samadhi. Utterly oblivious to her outward garb as a woman, she knew herself as the changeless soul. From that plane, she was joyously greeting another devotee of God. She led me by the hand into her automobile. "Ananda Moyama, I am delaying your journey," I protested. "Father, I am meeting you for the first time in this life, after ages," she said. "Please, do not leave yet." We sat together in the rear seats of the car. The blissful mother soon entered the immobile, ecstatic state. Her beautiful eyes glanced heavenward and half open became stilled, gazing in the near, far, inner Elysium. The disciples chanted gently, "Victory to the Divine Mother." I have found many men of God realization in India, but never before I had met such an exalted woman saint. Her gentle face was burnished with the ineffable joy that had given her the name of Blissful Mother. Long black tresses lay loosely behind her unveiled head. A red dot of sandalwood paste on her forehead symbolized the spiritual eye ever open within her. Tiny face, tiny hands, tiny feet, a contrast to her spiritual magnitude. I put some questions to a nearby chela, who, Ananda Moyama, remained entranced. The Blissful Mother travels widely in India. In many parts she has hundreds of disciples, the chela told me. Her courageous efforts have brought about many desirable social reforms. Although a Brahmin, the saint recognizes no caste distinctions. A group of us always travel with her, looking after her comforts. We have to mother her. She takes no notice of her body. If no one gave her food, she would not eat or make inquiries. Even when the meals are placed before her, she does not touch them. To prevent her disappearance from this world, we disciples feed her with our own hands. For days together, she often stays in divine trance, scarcely breathing, her eyes unwinking. One of her chief disciples is her husband. Many years ago, soon after their marriage, he took the vow of silence. The chela pointed to a broad-shouldered, fine-featured man with long hair and hoary beard. He was standing quietly in the midst of the gathering, his hands folded in a disciple's reverential attitude. Refreshed by her dip in the infinite, Ananda Moyama was now focusing her consciousness on the material world. "Father, please tell me where you stay," her voice clear and melodious, "at present in Calcutta or Ranchi, but soon I shall be returning to America." "America?" "Yes. An Indian woman saint would be sincerely appreciated there by spiritual seekers. Would you like to go?" "If Father can take me, I will go." This reply caused her nearby disciples to start in alarm. 20 or more of us travel with the Blissful Mother," one of them told me firmly. "We could not live without her. Wherever she goes, we must go." Reluctantly, I abandoned the plan as possessing an impractical feature of spontaneous enlargement. "Please come at least to Ranchi with your disciples," I said, on taking leave of the saint. "As a divine child yourself, you will enjoy the little ones in my school." "Whenever Father takes me, I will gladly go." A short time later, the Ranchi Vidyalaya, it was in gala array for the saint's promised visit. The youngsters looked forward to any day of festivity, no lessons, hours of music, and a feast for the climax. Victory, Anande Moema, Kai Jai. This reiterated chant from scores of enthusiastic little throats greeted the saint's party as it entered the school gates. Showers of marigolds, tinkle of cymbals, lusty blowing of conch shells, and a beat of the marimba drum. The blissful mother wandered smilingly over the sunny Vidyalaya grounds, ever carrying within her the portable paradise. It is beautiful here, Anande Moema said graciously, as I led her into the main building. She treated herself with a childlike smile by myself. The closest of dear disciples, friends, she made one feel, yet an aura of remoteness was ever around her, the paradoxical isolation of omnipresence. Please tell me something of your life. Father knows all about it. Why repeat it? She evidently felt that the factual history of one short incarnation was beneath notice. I laughed, gently repeating my question. Father, there is little to tell. She spread her graceful hands in a deprecatory gesture. My consciousness has never associated itself with this temporary body. Before I came on this earth, Father, I was the same. As a little girl, I was the same. I grew into womanhood, but still, I was the same. When the family in which I was born made arrangements to have this body married, I was the same. When passion drunk, my husband came to me and murmured endearing words, lightly touching my body. He received a violent shock, as if struck by lightning, for even then, I was the same. My husband knelt before me, folded his hands, and implored my pardon. Mother, he says, because I have desecrated your bodily temple by touching it with the thought of lust, not knowing that within it dwelt not my wife, but the Divine Mother, I take this solemn vow. I shall be your disciple, a celibate follower, ever caring for you in silence as a servant, never speaking to anyone again as long as I live. May I thus atone for my sin I have committed against you, my Guru. Even when I quietly accepted this proposal of my husband's, I was the same. And Father, in front of you now, I am the same. Ever afterward, though the dance of creation change around me in the hall of eternity, I shall be the same. Anande Moema sank into a deep meditative state. Her form was statue still. She had fled to her ever-calling kingdom. The dark pools of her eyes appeared lifeless and glassy. This expression is often present when saints remove their consciousness from the physical body, which is then hardly more than a piece of soulless clay. We sat together for an hour in the ecstatic trance. She returned to this world with a gay little laugh. Please, Anande Moema, I said, come with me to the garden. Mr. Wright will take some pictures. Of course, Father, your will is my will. Her glorious eyes retained the unchanging divine luster as she posed for many photographs. Time for the feast. Anande Moema squatted on her blanket seat, a disciple at her elbow to feed her. Like an infant, the saint obediently swallowed the food after the chela had brought it to her lips. It was plain that the blissful mother did not recognize any difference between the curries and the sweetmeats. As dusk approached, the saint left with her party amidst a shower of rose petals, her hands raised in blessing on the little lads. Their faces shone with affection she had effortlessly awakened. Thou shalt love the Lord thy God with all thy heart, and with all thy soul, and with all thy mind, and with all thy strength, Christ had proclaimed. This is the first commandment. Casting aside every inferior attachment, Anande Moema offers her sole allegiance to the Lord, not by hair-splitting distinctions of scholars, but by the sure logic of faith. The childlike saint had solved the only problem in human life, establishment of unity with God. Man has forgotten the stark simplicity, now befogged by a million issues. Refusing a monotheistic love to God, the nations disguise their infidelity by punctilious respect before the outward shines of charity. These humanitarian gestures are virtuous because for a moment they divert man's attention from himself, but they do not free him from his single responsibility in life, referred to by Jesus as the first commandment. The uplifting obligation to love God, assumed with man's first breath of air freely bestowed by his only benefactor. On one other occasion after a Ranchi visit, I had the opportunity to see Anandi Moima. She stood among her disciples some months later on a Serampore station platform, waiting for the train. "Father, I am going to the Himalayas," she told me. "Generous disciples have built a hermitage in Dehradun." As she boarded the train, I marveled to see that whether amidst a crowd, on a train, feasting, or sitting in silence, her eyes never looked away from God. Within me, I still hear her voice, an echo of measureless sweetness. "Behold, now and always, one with the eternal, I am ever the same." Of course, as the years proceeded, many disciples, both east and west, came to Anandi Moima, and her life and events have been recorded by many. Our own dear mother went to see her at one point, and it was an interesting thing that happened while she was there. Mother described that she sat in amongst the people who were sitting in front of this saint who was seated slightly up on a dais. And that as she sat there, Mother was a few rows back, but that Ma would throw fruit and flowers directly to Mother, and pretty soon Mother had a whole lap full of fruit and flowers from the saint. And as God would have arranged it, Dayamata, who is the president of Self-Realization Fellowship that Mother had been excommunicated from at one point, came in with her entourage and sat down. And during that time, Ma looked at Mother and then looked at Dayamata and then back to Mother and then back at Dayamata. And Mother felt that very definitely Anandi Moima was saying, "Why don't you make amends here and come back together?" And Mother said that deep inside of her that she thought, yes, that I'm willing and I'm fine with letting everything go. And at that point, Dayamata got up with her entourage and walked out. And so that was the end of that. And so this great saint continued to just shower her blessings, met different disciples in India, and like disciples everywhere, there are many and various types that are there. And one disciple was telling me that they made it a competition that Ma would get up sometimes in the middle of the night at any spontaneous time, get into her car and just leave without telling anybody, no itinerary, nothing. And so disciples would jump into their cars as soon as they were alerted that she was on the move and get in and follow behind her. And it became a kind of a game as to who could be directly behind Ma's car, first in line, you might say. And so they had a car and a driver, and the car was brand new. And the driver, they kept on egging on, he and his fellow disciple, to pass the other cars so that they would be first in line right after Ma. And they were taking crazy kind of chances of passing on corners and doing everything to get into the right position. Well, this had gone on for so long, and eventually Ma's car pulled over into a petrol station and she got gasoline. Everybody was waited along on the side waiting. Nobody would pass Ma's car, of course. That would be very disrespectful. But he was very determined to be first in line. So they pulled away from the petrol pumps, and the window rolled down, and Ma's hand came out through the window of the car that she was riding in and pointed towards their car. Oh, for 30, 40, 50 seconds or so. And then the car hand went back and the window went back up and their car proceeded. When his driver went to put their car into gear and to leave, the transmission was broken and the car didn't go anywhere. So that was the end of their chasing and taking chances and all the rest of it, and perhaps they learned a good lesson out of it. These saints are wonderful, and we are all the benefactories of generations of saints. And what is it that makes a saint? It is one who has transcended the cocoon of human consciousness that insulates us from divine consciousness. They have grown out of that cocoon and emerged into the butterfly of divine consciousness. And they fly free in that divine consciousness. There were disciples who used to come to Papa, and perhaps they were expecting something extraordinary, like there would be, they would see light emanating and shining from Papa, or they would see some other kinds of extraordinary signs. And he said, what? Do you expect us to have horns? Or what? You know, what? Some kind of outward sign. And so how can one recognize a saint? And even Papa, who is in a state of God realization, said that it's not easy, that he could not always recognize who is in an absolute state and a relative state and so on. But there are certain signs. Although personalities can change, we have this wonderful variety of personalities within our own guru lineage and other great saints and masters that we know. Some are very strict and stern. Some have tremendous sense of humor. Some have a great sense of fun, and others are very rigid in their style. There's no absolute outward form that would indicate somebody is in this high state of realization. Generally speaking, they are always dharmic. They do the right thing. But occasionally, even great masters can break the rules because they're above the law. And so we're left with this conundrum. If we ourselves are in a state of ignorance, how can we tell whether somebody else, a potential teacher or a saint or any individual that we meet, is in a high state of realization? And the greatest indicator is our own internal state when we meet such a one. Does that one lift our consciousness up? Do we feel transformed? Do we feel that we are closer to the divine consciousness? Now, sometimes we are disturbed by a realized saint because we are clinging on to the things of the senses and clinging on to the ego nature within ourselves. And so it's not always the case that we feel in an uplifted state. Oftentimes, when I was with Mother, especially for any extended period of time, I could come away with a headache, because the tremendous spiritual power that she was emanating was stretching my nervous system, both the physical nervous system and the subtle nervous system of the nadis of the body. And because they were being stretched, it was painful at times. But I always felt lifted up closer to being with Mother, even in casual circumstances. And there was never a time that I observed Mother that I did not see her operating out from a higher divine consciousness. Now, she could meet anybody on any level. She had a wonderful sense of humor. She could joke with people and play with people. I remember there's times when she would take up particular kinds of games and play them with people. And she was very competitive. She always wanted to win. And so even games of this nature took on a serious teaching nature within her, because she would test people. She would see where their attachments were, where their ego patterns came. She loved people with stronger personalities. She didn't necessarily want people with retiring personalities. If she wanted the ego all the way out there, maybe it's easier to kill the ego if it's all out there in the open. So it made her job a little bit easier than if it's hiding behind some facade of a persona. But anyway, she took us all. And she took us exactly where we were at. And she worked with us. She worked with us in a human sense. She worked with us in a divine sense. In a human sense, it might be correct of us in the period of the 70s, and as I mentioned in my writing, many of the kind of basic values and kinds of habits were being questioned. But when she, as a lady, would get out of the car, if you were a gent, she would expect you to come around and open the door. And if you're going into a building, that you would open the door for her, that you treated her as a lady. And she liked that, and she encouraged it. In fact, she demanded that as a disciple that you treat her that way. Because she wanted to focus on the respect that there can be and should be between men and women. She liked the role of being a woman. And she didn't shy away from it. And she is so different in that way than many of the saints and many of the ones that you meet on the spiritual path and in different spiritual teachings, that she loved this human life. Because when she looked out through her own two eyes, she did not see a world of illusion. She saw God's expression through everything that is, through architecture, through interior design, through clothing, through makeup, through every aspect of what it is to be human. And she was lifting it up in our consciousness and in our minds to that divine level. It's a wonderful precept to keep within our lives, that every aspect of your life, whether it's business, whether it's home, whether it's family, whether it's friendship, everything in your life is lifted up to that divine level. There is nothing in your life that needs to be held apart and separated from your spiritual path. This is purely an artificial distinction created by the human mind and nothing else. We must be cured of this idea of separation if we are to be in a pure state of self or God realization. There can be no quarter taken with this. It must be total and absolute. But you know, we want to keep something for ourselves. We want to keep a corner of our mind or our life or our habit patterns as something separate from God, as if there is anything that we can hide from God or that is truly separate from the divine. If God is everything that is and created everything that is, has become everything that is, then how can there be any part of your life that is separate, you see? The only question is, are you attuning yourself with the divine consciousness, or are you attuning yourself with a field of separation from God? Master talked a lot about attunement with the Guru. Now this means tuning in to the consciousness of the Guru. When you hear the Guru speak, when you're in their presence and there is a certain upliftment within your own consciousness, there is a signature that comes along that is the Guru's. It's pure God, and yet it has that individual's personality, you might say, imprinted upon it. And so it is both. It is pure divine vibration, and it is distinctly the individual of the Guru. And so I found that anywhere that I traveled in this wide world, that I could feel Mother's presence. Once I was in the Sahara Desert. We were traveling in military trucks. There is no road. It was completely absent of any vegetation. It was all the rolling sand dunes. And while on a break there, I smelled Mother's perfume that she wore at the time. And then I felt her presence there and there, out in the middle of nowhere, except for the sand dunes and a few people that had been riding on this truck. I felt Mother's presence so greatly. Meanwhile, she was back in Seattle, Washington, halfway around the world. And so time nor space, neither are barriers for this divine consciousness that the Guru is in. And you can feel that consciousness. And when you attune yourself in that way, you feel the thoughts and the vibrations of the Guru upon you. And in fact, that death has not been a barrier for that either. That death of this body is not the death of the spirit, not the death of the soul, not the death of the consciousness that had once inhabited that body. The body is the least expression of a divine consciousness. Now, for most human beings, it seems like the be-all, end-all. And there are many people who even question whether they'll have anything once the body is gone, because the body is king. It's everything. But for a divinely realized being, the body is just merely an expression. It's a vehicle. It's true, unlike a car, for instance, you don't necessarily feel what the car feels as you do in the body. Although sometimes if you bump into something or something else happens to the car, you feel it in your own body. But this body is just simply a vehicle. And when you leave it behind, it's just simply saying this vehicle has served its use, thank you very much, and you move on to the next vehicle. And you know, when you really come to realization, you know that this body is like a heavy lead overcoat that's being worn on a sweltering hot day. And when you take it off, it is such a relief not to have this physical body as something to contend with anymore. There are wonderful things about it, of course. But we really are happy when that time comes and we can leave it behind. And we now exist in the more subtle bodies. The astral body is a wonderful vehicle. And it can travel at the speed of thought. And it is a mass of electricity, for lack of a better word. It is a mass of life energy. And it takes on color and it takes on form. And when you're in the astral body, it appears that astral form and the astral worlds appear just as substantive when you look out through those astral eyes as this physical realm does to your physical eyes. Sometimes when we hear the word subtle, it is more subtle, but it is just as distinctly real feeling to the consciousness when you're existing in that astral body. And the astral realm is wonderful. It is filled with intense and vivid colors and forms. It is much more pliable than this physical world. This physical world tends to operate but defined by the physical principles of physics and chemistry and other areas of study that have defined some of these principles. But God is always and forever the supreme force. And so with God's injection of divine will can transcend any of those laws, but generally we operate by those laws of gravity and physics that we have accepted here. But we should always remember that there is a greater reality to this physical reality, and great beings attuned to God or God Himself can transcend any of those principles at any time. But in the astral realm, there are more subtle realms. And there we can think with a thought and we can materialize exactly what it is that we have thought, and it comes into form. And it's such an easier place to be. And in general, when people think about heaven, they think about the astral realms. And this to them is heaven. But really, heaven is just a step up from that kind of astral heaven. It's just a step up from this material realm. And it does not represent the state of absolute realization. It does not cure the most basic and fundamental problem to an individual soul, and that is the realization of God. To do that, you must go beyond the astral, and beyond the astral is the causal. And in the causal, again, we hear the word even more subtle, and to our material mind, we think less substantive. But really, when we're in the causal, it seems more real and more intense than either the physical or the astral. And the causal dispenses with the life energy. And now you are in a production of pure thought. And whatever vast thoughts you might bring in, or how minute they might be, you instantly bring them into creation. And it's a wonderful realm. And there's so much freedom there, even more freedom than the astral realm. If you were to assume an astral body from the causal, it feels rather like a heavy lead overcoat in comparison to the freedom of the causal realm. So the causal realm is tremendous. It's tremendous. And only beings who are very closely attuned to divine consciousness can be in that causal. And yet in that causal is not yet the full and complete state of realization. Because even there, there's a sense of separation from total unity of the divine. That sense of individuality continues to reign and be a dominant factor, even though it is much more subtle, much more free, much more expanded than anything in the two lower realms. And from that causal realm is a complete emergence into pure spirit. And now all sense of separation, all sense of form, which is limiting, dissolves. And you find yourself in a realm that feels even more real, more profound, more moving, more of everything that your heart has ever desired. Sri Yukteswar says in the Holy Science that is the fulfillment of all the heart's desires. Now we think of our desires and we think, oh, well, they're not very godly, many of them. They run contrary to what God wants. In fact, I get frustrated by my own desire nature. But really, if you were to analyze it and go deeper and deeper and deeper with every single one of your desires, you would realize that the real answer to your desires does not reside in some form or situation that you have imagined for yourself. Perhaps you are striving to get to. That real freedom, real fulfillment comes only when you contact the divine and God comes in and fills up that empty space that has been seeking its complement all this time. And soul and spirit, Atman and Paramatman, become as one. They merge. And in this mergence, the individuality dissolves and becomes merged with the infinite. But you know, something happens then. It doesn't always, but it can. And it's not something that is well known. But that spirit can then, and once again, manifest itself as the individual. Only now, because there is no karma, there is no law of cause and effect that is influencing the consciousness of that individuality, there is only a pure spiritual expression through the individuality. It represents no sense of separation. Our material minds, because it thinks in material ways, thinks, oh, well, when I dispense of this body, then I'll be free. Then I'll have happiness. Then I'll have bliss. Then I'll know the answers when this body is dead and I've gone beyond. But that's only the material mind's conception of it. There is nothing while you're living in a human body that inhibits or stops you from realizing your oneness with the divine consciousness. There's nothing. It all happens right here. this is the time, this is the place for you to come into that state of God realization. And when you do, and as you do, this state that Anandamayi Ma was talking about, before I was born, I was the same. You could equally say, I am the same, because it's the I am, the eternal present, the eternal self. I am the same. When you're a little child, I am the same. Any stage along the way. I once described time and space as being like a book, time in particular. And the book is already written. And you can open up that book at any particular place and start to read. And what you get is the narrative of that moment. But then you can close the book, open it up someplace else, and begin to read another place. And you get a completely different time and place, depending on where you open it up to and where you begin to read. It's all there. And your consciousness is just simply focused in this time and place of the story, the story of your soul's unfoldment. You know, we come into this world and the world seems so big, so vast. When you're a little child just learning to walk, the world seems like a neat world of knees. You look around, you see all the knees of all these adults. And gradually you get up and maybe it becomes a world of waists, then shoulders, and then heads as you grow higher and higher. Your perspective of this world changes. But sometimes, consciously, we don't change. We feel like everything and everyone is so much bigger than we are and takes on so much gravity. We don't really own our life. Now, you can do that from an ego standpoint, but that's not really what I'm referring to. When you really own your life, you identify with God that is within you. And that becomes the center of your life. God becomes bigger. God within you becomes bigger than any form on the outside of you. And this is an important psychological step to take, where you really own your life. You really step into your life fully. And as you feel God moving inside of you, it changes you and it transforms you. And the power center is within you. Now, this does not trigger your ego sense that you think that you're so great, you think you're so mighty, because you contrast it with the human individuality that you feel, and you know that in contrast, in comparison to the divine consciousness that you experienced in contacting God, that your human consciousness is as nothing. It knows nothing. It has no power. You realize that everything comes from this divine source. And so you can say with Jesus, I of myself am nothing. It is my Father who doeth the works. It's not Jesus trying to be humble. He's stating an important spiritual truth. He's recognized that of himself, he has nothing. God is the author of everything that is. And so you really take ownership of your life. You really step into your life. You quit putting yourself down. And you quit feeling like you're the smallest one ever. Amazingly enough, Mother said that even after she had gained her full sense of God realization, that God continued to, you might say, play the field of ignorance inside of her. She still felt like she was the smallest one around. And when she met Elizabeth Hike, she introduced herself and she said that she was a disciple of Paramahansa Yogananda. Elizabeth Hike had a negative reaction. She said, oh, his autobiography, it's just filled with I. And Mother, who had usually just jumped right in, somebody criticized her master, and she stood back a bit. But she said, oh, she says, I read your book, Initiation, on the plane right over here. And in that book, it was I. And as Elizabeth Pike said, but that was about another incarnation. Mother said, nevertheless, it was about your soul and your evolution. It was about you. And suddenly, Elizabeth Pike took a step back. And then she suddenly had a realization. And she said to Mother, she says, please forgive me. I did not realize who you are. She said, why do you go around thinking always that you're the littlest one? Do you not realize you are greater than anyone that you have met in this lifetime or anyone that you will meet? Why do you not stand up and say, I am that I am? And I remember when Mother came back from India that time, and that was in Switzerland, but when she went on to India and then came back here. And she was telling that story. And it was some time later that she followed up with that story. And she said, you know, the other day I was sitting in my home and I was thinking about what that Elizabeth Pike said. And I stood up. And I said those words. I said, I am that I am. And she said a tremendous experience happened as a result. And it seemed to change that place in Mother that she always felt like that she was the littlest one. Now in this experience, it was not replaced with the ego saying, oh, what a great fellow I am. It was a recognition and experience in God. And you recognize the greatness of God inside of you. You see, there's a vast difference between that and the arrogance of an ego. And so, to put ourselves at the center of life does not mean to puff ourselves up egotistically, but it's to recognize that the life that God is within you, is all-powerful, is all-knowing, is everything, is the answer to every one of your heart's desires. And that as you move through these various levels of the physical and the astral and the causal, that you always look at any one of these realms with an eye for gaining your total and complete freedom. And when you do this, you fulfill life's greatest principle, to love the Lord thy God with all thy mind, with all thy soul, with all thy strength, with everything that you have. Because when you put God first, when you have that loyalty to God and the truth, it will take you all the way to your complete and total realization, wherein you will find that freedom, that love, that joy, that bliss, everything that your heart has been desiring. When I came to Mother, there were two things that I wanted. And I don't know if I would have articulated it in the same way at the time, but I know now that it's true. I wanted to know the truth. And secondly, I wanted bliss because I was in such a state of spiritual pain at the time. And by being loyal to Mother and our gurus and God, and as I said, I failed many times. And I do not say that with any sense of pride. There was pain both for myself and for others whenever I fell short of the goal. But that I didn't give up. I stayed true and I stayed loyal. And I can tell you with absolute and firm conviction that it is through that loyalty of staying true to the course that has brought me through so much of what kept me separate from God. And I know that it is extremely valuable to have that sense of loyalty. It cannot be a blind sense of loyalty. Eventually, that will run out of gas. It has to be one that is rooted in your own realization, your own love. But when it is, it's such a powerful combination that you know that whether it takes from now to eternity, you will never give up. You will never give in. You will strive until you attain the divine goal. And when you know that through and through and through, then there is nothing that can keep you from your own divine realization. Remember this most wonderful principle of loving God first and being loyal to Him and to your path. As we sat before meditating and concentrating upon God, the sense of purity, the sense of upliftment, the light and the joy that I was experiencing, I didn't want to start speaking at all because of the feeling of that. But you know, the wonderful thing is that in opening this mouth and beginning to speak, I feel no diminution of that experience at all. It all becomes merged. It all becomes one. And when you know that all the way through, then you have attained the eternal freedom. Reading from Papa's quote on the back page of the journal. What is faith? Unquestioning surrender to God's will is faith. Whatever happens is attributed to the workings of God. God is taken as great, good, and kind. He is the sole dispenser of all things. There is nothing to be anxious about and nothing to be afraid of. All is His doing. So we are all the recipients of these great masters and saints down through history. And it is up to each one of us to take the truth that we are taught and to put it into action. This we can and we must do. And if you will, you will be so very happy and fulfilled that you did. Please pray with me. O Heavenly Father, Divine Mother, I feel the wonder and the beauty of Thy glorious presence in every part of my being. My heart is bursting with my love for Thee. I kneel in adoration at Thy feet and surrender myself to Thee. I feel the power of Thy perfection surging in every cell of my body, my mind and my intelligence are radiant with Thy healing light. My soul is filled with the ecstasy and bliss of my communion with Thee. I and my Father are one. Blessed Spirit, I am He. Peace. Bliss. Amen. Pronoun.